So, we've been talking about Jewish identity so far for the year, and I actually, at the top, I thought I would just take a second to sort of sum up what we've done so far, because it's scattered going all the way back to the fall. We talked about what Jewish identity is, in the sense of what defines someone as being Jewish, and we dealt with the Brother Daniel story and ethnicity and ideology, and then last time, just a couple of weeks ago, we talked about Israel. But we also talked about promotion of Jewish identity. We talked about whether there's a mitzvah of converting people, or do we expect non-Jews to become Jewish. And we talked about, on the other hand, protecting our identity and the problem of martyrdom, and how that played out in the Middle Ages. And what I wanted to do now, this time as well as next time, is to talk about Jewish traits. Meaning, are there specific behaviors that are supposed to be Jewish behaviors? Now, our enemies have always said they know Jewish behaviors, right? Our enemies have decided that we are that we're very cunning and that we're unethical in business and whatnot. but you can't do that every time I cough. I'm going to cough a lot. But thank you. But what I want to do this evening is actually to define Jews by what we are not, in the sense that the biblical text takes pains to contrast Jews with their neighbors. And at various points in our history, we split off from our neighbors. And so to figure out what is being identified as sort of what the Jew is supposed to be like, as opposed to what the Jew is not like. And then next time, to talk about it a little bit more, some of the positive traits. So what we're going to do today is talk more about the negatives, what are we not, and then the next time, so what are we? But I had to start with this source that I mentioned last time, but I found it so I could actually bring it to you intact. Source number 2. I'm pretty sure I mentioned it last time. The marijuana researcher from Israel, right? I think I mentioned it last time.
No.
Okay, even better. There's a fellow named Rafal Meshulam, who is one of the leading experts in the world in marijuana.
What does that mean, an expert in marijuana?
It's the science of it, how it works, what the compounds are in it that are active, what exactly is its impact on the body, and that kind of thing. So there's an article here from National Geographic, June 2015, called High Science: Science Seeks to Unlock Marijuana Secrets. In 1992, Meshulam's quest for quantification led him from the plant itself to the inner recesses of the human brain. That year, he and several colleagues made an extraordinary discovery. They isolated the chemical made by the human body that binds to the same receptor in the brain that THC does. In other words, THC is the active compound. That's the compound in the drug that actually impacts the brain. And they found the receptor in the brain to which THC attaches itself. And this fellow Meshulam found what it is in the body that's normally supposed to go there. Because you don't have a receptor in the brain unless there's something, some biological reason for it. There must be something the body makes that normally goes there. So he discovered what the compound was, and he named it. Meshulam named it anandamide, from the Sanskrit for, quote, supreme joy. Right? He names the compound that bonds to this receptor, to the receptor that normally responds to marijuana, he names it supreme joy. But he takes a word from Sanskrit. So the National Geographic article says in parentheses, when asked why he didn't give it a Hebrew name, he replies, because in Hebrew there are not so many words for happiness. Jews don't like being happy.
That's really ridiculous.
That was
absolutely.
There are so many words for joy.
Absolutely, right? If you ever go to a wedding and you hear Ashavara, Sasa, Bisimcha, Gila, Rina, Nitsa, Nego, of course we do. I don't know what is it. I mean, the answer may be that he's been sampling his research. I don't know, but the statement of it just to me leads to the question. So, what are Jewish traits? He thinks that being glum, is a Jewish trait. Maybe he watched Woody Allen movies. I don't know what this is, you know, what his problem is. But I like to determine Jewish traits based on what the Torah's vision for the Jew is. So what you find...
Go on, please.
No, that's all right. Thanks.
They're very, very effective.
I'm good. I appreciate it. Thank you. It doesn't actually hurt. It doesn't bother me. I'm at the end of a cold. So the Torah presents several major splits which lead to the formation of the Jewish people, where starting from creation, there are branchings in whatever God created. First, there are branchings from plant, fish, bird, animal, and human being. But then there are further branchings among human beings leading to the formation of the Jewish people. And each time there's a fork in the road, one way leads to the Jews and one way leads to those who are not Jewish. And I think each time we're meant to learn something from the split. Now, there are many splits that you could bring. Right? Name one of the splits in the Torah between what ends up being the Jewish people and what does not end up being the Jewish people. Yaakov and Esav, Isaac and Ishmael.
Kashrut.
Well, Kashrut is a practice, but in terms of the people, those are two perfect examples, which I'm not going to go into. Even though they make perfect sense, and I think we could, if this were much more than a one-hour session, I would go with that. I would also add in Lot and Abraham, right? Abraham and Lot, they both have a lot of cattle. The shepherds are fighting, and so Abraham says, "You go one way, I'll go the other way. You pick where you want to go." And Lot says, "Oh, there's this beautiful piece of real estate called Sodom. I think I'd really like to settle there." And of course, that doesn't work out so well. But that's the area that he chooses, and that's a split in its own right, which is worthy of its own discussion, but I want to pick three splits. The first one is the split between the sons of Noah, Shem, Ham, Yafet, which is what creates Semites, right? And in order to have anti-Semites, you have to have Semites. So that's the first one, is the one that creates Semitism, so to speak. The second one that I'm going to want to look at is when Abraham and Sarah split off from Aram to go to their land, right? Leave your birthplace and so on. And then the third one is when we leave Egypt, because there we actually split off from ourselves. And I'll explain what I mean when we get to the third one, but we have two others that we're going to go through first. But that's what I'd like to do to show what is happening each time there is a fork like this. So we start out with the sons of Noah. And specifically, a story which you probably have heard of, which occurs after the flood. What happens to Noah after the flood?
He becomes intoxicated.
Yes, he gets drunk. That's actually not the first thing that happens to him after the flood.
He plants vineyards.
Well, before he plants the vineyards, he brings an offering to God. Right? That should matter. He should get credit for that, too. He shouldn't just be the one who got drunk. Then he has this other story, which is what we're actually going to focus on anyway, so we might as well. Take a look, please, at source number 3. Genesis chapter 9. And the sons of Noah, who left the ark, were Shem, Ham, and Yafet. Okay, those are the three. And Ham is the father of Canaan. Ham had several children, not only Canaan, but Canaan is the one who's going to be relevant to the story, presumably, and that's why it's mentioned here. We'll see. These are the three sons of Noah, and from them the entire world spread, right, an accomplishment. And Noah, man of the earth, set forth and planted a vineyard, and he drank of the wine, and became intoxicated, and he uncovered himself in his tent. Right, this story is not new to people. And Ham, father of Canaan, saw the erva of his father, and he told his two brothers outside. Erva is not a word that is easily translated. Erva is probably best translated as that which is normally covered. But that's too clumsy to write in a sentence, so I just wrote erva in the sentence. I think nakedness is usually the way it's translated, which is more or less what that means. But it's a part of the body that's normally concealed. So He's undressed in his tent. His son Ham, father of Canaan, sees the erva of his father, and he tells his two brothers outside. And Shem and Yefet took the garment, some garment, which evidently they knew of, because it's a good garment, and placed it on their shoulders. And they walked backward, and they covered the erva of their father. And their faces were backward, and they did not see their father's erva. Clear? So there's a lot going on in this story. I mean, why does Noah choose to plant a vineyard? Or really, I mean, it's worth noting, Nachmanides points out, he didn't just plant one grapevine. He planted a vineyard. Like, that takes work. And one of the commentators, Rashi, is bothered, because he says, well, where did he get the seeds from? And his answer is, this was premeditated. Noah got on the boat with grape seeds, planning to plant a vineyard. I've seen it written, although I'm not sure how much credence to give it, that this is the first example of PTSD, right, of post-traumatic stress disorder. And while it sounds strange, the truth of the matter is, like, he saw the world die. Meaning he got on the boat, and he had neighbors, relatives, a whole world. And he comes out, and they're all dead. Like, it's not, so, you know, we laugh, but it's not such a funny thing. That's the thing with this story in general. They teach this story to kids when they're really, really young and give them cute toys, right? It's one of the best Bible toys, so to speak, is a Noah's Ark with all the, you know, stuff, the animals that are on it. But, like, this is not a children's story. This is a horrible, brutal, gruesome story. It's the death of the world. So Noah comes out of that. He plants a vineyard and he gets drunk, and you know, it's really not so surprising. And there are a number of things that come from this story. I didn't bring you the end of the story, actually. Did anybody remember what happens after this when Noah wakes up? What does he do when he wakes up?
Doesn't he have something to do with his daughters?
No, that's Lot. Lot was the one with his daughters. Yeah. That at least we're spared in this story. He realizes what has happened, and he curses Canaan, the son of Ham. Well, the because is what I actually want to come to, is what was he cursing him for? And he blesses the two older brothers, or they're not necessarily older, but he blesses Shem and Yefet, the brothers who had respectfully covered him up. As a matter of fact, the curse that he gives Canaan is in Hebrew, Eved Avadim Yehiye Le'achav. He will be a slave of slaves to his brethren. Christian ministers took that as justification for slavery in North America. They said that's the curse of Ham, because Ham has multiple sons, Cush, Mitzrayim, Put, and Canaan. Cush is Ethiopia. So they took that as justification for slavery, because they said, see, that is the problem is that it's the wrong kid. The curse is Canaan, not Cush. They mixed up the kids in their attempt to justify slavery. There were Jewish sources that did this too, but it was basically a church thing. But another piece that comes out of this story is the sort of mixed feelings that you find in Judaism towards wine. You know, on the one hand, we use wine for all of our greatest occasions, right? When we use wine in a wedding, right? You have your blessing on wine under the chuppah. We use wine for kiddush. At a bris, there's a bracha. There's a blessing on wine. Wine to end Shabbat and holidays for Havdalah, we use it for all of these things. At the same time, there's a definite suspicion of wine, a feeling like you could end up like Noah. So it actually goes both ways. There's a passage in the Talmud which works very, very well in the original Hebrew. So I'm going to say it in the Hebrew and then translate it. The English is not nearly as good. It says there are three ways in which you can tell a person's true character. Bikiso, Bikaso, Bikoso. Which has a great ring to it. But in English, what it means is his wallet, his anger, and his drinking. You can tell a lot about a person when you know what they spend on, what gets them angry, and how they act when they're drunk. Those are your insights into the human being. So in any case, that's not where we're going with this right now. What I want to ask is, why is this story in the Torah? Why is the, you know, tell me that Noah saved the world, because he did, and then let him exit stage left. Why do I need this story about what happened when Noah got drunk? What's it here for?
As a separation between what becomes of Yisrael and the rest?
What do you mean?
Georgia.
Oh. So you're saying it's a separation, but Noah is our interest.
To indicate what this is, that there
it's
is
going
to
come.
Okay. Could be. In other words, Noah belongs with the old world. Noah's not going to be part of the Jewish people. And he's our ancestor as much as he's anyone else's. But to say this is, you know, what we're coming from, could be.
To take him down a notch so that he is not as close to divine instruction.
Mm-hmm. So we're saying that he's not as great as...
he's not Moses.
Okay, but why would we want to do that to somebody?
But he's human. And so, we want to
depict him authentically. Okay.
And the story of the three sons.
Right, the story of the three sons. I'm going to come back to that. I think there's more here. I think there's a great literary parallel to be seen between what happens in the Garden of Eden with the fruit and Noah with the fruit. Mm. Right? We get in trouble with fruits. That's the moral of the story. Stay away from the fruit, eat vegetables. I think that's one element here. I think also, it's a fundamentally good thing that he wants to plant things. You know, we want him to rebuild the earth. The Midrash on the beginning of the portion of Noah emphasizes that it's good that he wants to plant, but, you know, good attempts can still go awry. And this, you know, this does. Perhaps it's also to say that evil wasn't destroyed with the flood. You know, God destroys the earth, saying, let me get rid of the old, but the new world still has problems. Maybe it's a warning to say, no matter how great you are, even if you're a Noah, you're still going to have a weakness. Things can still go wrong.
But didn't he plant other things?
This is the only thing we're told about, which may in and of itself speak volumes. But we don't know much about the rest of his life. You know, once you've saved the world, really, how much is there to tell? But we don't know what he did other than this remarkable story and that of bringing the sacrifice. But take a look at number four. Right, Moses Nachmanides, Ramban, says, the purpose of this story is also to teach us about Noah's children. That's a key element. This portion, he writes, in source number four, was recorded to teach that due to his sins, Canaan was to be an eternal slave. And Abraham acquired the land. And Noah's wine is recorded because it includes a greater warning than the portion of the Nazir, right? There's a portion in the Torah of the Nazir about refraining from drinking wine. So that's a nice moral lesson about the harm that wine can cause. But nothing is as good as an actual story. You know, telling me laws about drinking doesn't affect me the way that a story about somebody's downfall does. For wine caused even the perfect tzaddik, whose righteousness saved the world, to sin and brought him to shame and the curse of his children. So it's a warning. This is the a public service announcement about alcohol.
So he's describing Noah as the perfect tzaddik.
Yeah.
But that's not what the Torah says.
What do you mean?
He said he's manot.
Ah, so that's a very interesting question, in which I must admit I have a bias. The opening verse in the Torah portion called Noah says the following, as Pearly notes. These are the chronicles of Noah, descendants, chronicles, you can translate the word in different ways. Noah was a righteous man, perfect in his generations. With God walked Noah. That's the end of the verse. So, Rashi there comments that there's a Talmudic debate when it says he was perfect in his generations, generations plural, because there's pre-flood and post-flood, but when it says he's perfect in his generations, there are two different ways you could take that. One way is the way that Pearlie just took it, which is to say, sure, for his time, compared to the people he lived among, right, you know, he was perfect. Put him in a time when people are decent and moral. Remember, the sins of that generation are described as being horrible. We're talking about theft and kidnapping and rape and really like an abusive society that just hasn't gotten it together in terms of just living a moral life. So, compared to them, he looks great. Put it next to Abraham, put it next to Moses, and not so much. That's one way to read it. However, I prefer the other way to read it, which is perfect despite his generations. In other words, he's living in a world in which everybody but him is corrupt and horrible. And yet, he manages, somehow, to keep it straight. That's a remarkable thing that he does. So I like to look on the bright side of people. I like to read it that way. The upshot, though, of it is, Nachmanides sides with me, that Noah is a great man, and yet he falls, and that's the lesson of the wine. But look at the opening line again in number 4, that the purpose of this portion is to teach that due to his sins, Canaan is an eternal slave, and Abraham is getting the land. How did he know that Canaan sinned? Was there a sin of Canaan anywhere in this passage in number 3?
Not respecting his father.
Canaan? Canaan wasn't the player. What did he do? Ham, the father of Canaan.
Oh, yeah.
It's not Canaan.
Sins of the father.
Maybe, but he had 4 kids. Why are you visiting it on this one specifically?
The others might have had a few problems.
This is also true. So, the answer is that when we read the text, we noticed that in the opening line, it said, Ham is the father of Canaan. And then again, a couple of sentences later, Ham, father of Canaan. And then in a verse that I didn't bring you after this, it says, Noah wakes up and he knows what his smallest, his youngest son, Beno HaKatan, had done to him. And from this, the commentators say, what's going on is, Canaan was the one who actually found his grandfather in this state. And he told his father, Ham, and that was how everything came out. And that's why Noah chooses to curse him, because of what Canaan had done. So that this whole story, and I brought you in number 5, when the text says that he saw the erva of his father, Rashi brings you a midrash that describes pretty graphically, it wasn't just that he saw him, but that he did things to him. He abused his father, and I'm not going to read it aloud, you can see it there on the sheet. Sorry? Well, Canaan slash Ham. Some, whether it was the younger or the, whether it was the son or the father is not clear to me. Correct. This story does not necessarily happen right after the flood. Rabbi Avraham Ibn Ezra, one of the classic commentators here, says it's years and years later. It wasn't an immediate follow-on on the flood. But the point here is, and what I wanted to draw from this story, is this is the identity that the Torah gives to Canaan. Remember, the figures who appear there are all named with names that are going to apply to regions later on. So one of the people there is Yavan. Yavan is Greece. One of them is Cush, which is Ethiopia. And Canaan is going to be the land that we get in the end, the land of Canaan. So in other words, what this text is trying to do, and that's what Nachmanides picks up on in source number 4, is to say, these are the Canaanites. You want to know what the Canaanites are like? Go back to their ancestor. Here's your foundation story. This is who they are, effectively. And if you take a look at number 6, you find it play out. This was in last week's Torah portion. The Jews are warned like the deeds of Egypt in which you lived, you shall not do. Don't be like the Egyptians. And like the deeds of Canaan, to which I am bringing you, you shall not do. You shall not follow their laws. And then it continues with all sorts of laws about incest and about sexual immorality. So that what we see in this first split is sexual morality. That's the very first lesson that we see here. And you might look at it and say, well, is that such a big, important lesson? But I think it is a big, important lesson. Because what's the very first thing that God tells humanity?
Pru
Urvu. Bear fruit and multiply. Yeah. Right? God says Adam needs an Eve in the very beginning of the Torah. It seems like that's a very narrow trait with which to begin our self-identification. But on the other hand, it plays out to major effect, and it's in many early biblical stories. Aside from this one, beyond the story of Noah. Anybody know the story? And it's okay if you don't. But the story of Lemech, Ada, and Tzila. Not a very familiar story for people, because it gets overshadowed. It appears in the Chumash, it appears in the biblical text, between the Garden of Eden and the Flood. So imagine, right, teachers in school, right, are trying to teach these stories. You've got the Garden of Eden, the Flood, and some guy who had two wives. And you'll see the story, and you'll realize that it's not such a big story. And, of course, it gets, you know, it gets overshadowed.
Skipped.
Yeah.
It's one of the parts they skipped.
Yeah. Well, the story is that there's a gentleman by the name of Lemech who has two wives, Ada and Tzila. And suddenly they want nothing to do with him. They have four sons. And suddenly the two wives have four sons and a daughter, and then they want nothing to do with him anymore, and he says to them, what's wrong? I haven't done anything wrong. Why are you not interested in me anymore? And then the text moves on. Mm-hmm. And we have no idea what's going on. So the Midrash explains, what he says is, the text actually says, have I killed a man? Have I killed a boy? So the Midrash explains that what actually happened was he killed his great-great-great-grandfather accidentally. There's a whole story involved. What happens, his great-great-great-grandfather was Cain, who was supposed to be killed after seven generations. That's his punishment. And Lemech, is the seventh generation. So they tell this whole story about how he killed Cain, and that's why they separated from him. That's one explanation. There are other explanations as well. I'm not going into it right now. What I wanted to catch, though, is the literal text. He has two wives, Ada and Tzila. Ada means pregnant. Tzila is something beautiful. It's a term used for something that's beautiful. And what the commentators see here is that actually he had two wives, and he wanted one to be the one who would bear the children. That's Ada. And he wanted one who would be the one who would just be beautiful. That was his goal. His wives are his property, and that's the way that he's going to treat them. Evidently, something in his plan didn't work, because Tzila ended up with kids. So somewhere along the line, his plot didn't quite pan out. But the point is, that is held up as an example of immoral conduct. It's something that's criticized there, in the very beginning of the Torah, and probably maybe that's why they skip it. But in the very beginning of the Torah, we're learning about morality, and morality in terms of relationships. Then you get to the Egyptian pharaoh kidnapping Sarah, and Abimelech, the king of the Philistines, kidnapping her as well, and the story of the people of Sodom and what they wanted to do to the visitors, and the kidnapping and rape of Dinah. You have all these stories all revolving around this point. So the very first split that we have is to shape our identity that we are supposed to be moral in these relationships. Clear? Are we good? Okay. That's the first split. The second split, more famous. Leave your land, right? Source number 7. And God said to Abram, leave your land, your birthplace, and your father's house to the land I will show you. And I will make you a great nation, and I will bless you and increase your name, and you will be a blessing. And I will bless those who bless you, and I will curse those who curse you, and with you all of the clans of the land shall be blessed. Right? Hopefully we're familiar. That's Abraham's split. He split from the land he had lived in. He grew up in a land called Aram. He actually goes to a midway point or so, a place called Haran. But he is being removed from his birthplace and from his family. Why is this story here in the Torah? And this is an easy one. It's our origin story. It's how we came to be. Right? This is how we became a nation. But look at the emphasis in the beginning of the text, in number 7. Leave your land, your birthplace, your father's house. Why the emphasis on all the different departures?
It's a definite separation from everything you have
on your own.
Right. Specific, a separation from everything you've known. Your land, your family, everything. As a matter of fact, when you work out the chronology for how old Abraham is at this point, you realize he left before his father died. Meaning, he was living at the time with his family in Haran, and he packed up and moved while his father was still alive, which would have been a no-no. That wasn't normally what you did. But he does so because he needs to make a complete break, and he will be a blessing. Right? We're told, he's instructed, you will be a blessing. Take a look at source number 8, where the commentator Rashi explains what that means to say, be a blessing. The blessings are now in your hands. Until now, God says, they were in my hand. I blessed Adam, Noah, and you. Now you shall bless those you choose. You will be the arbiter of blessing. You are the one who gives to others. That's what God says to him. It's a lesson in generosity, which plays out. Because Abraham is known in the biblical text for his generosity. Give me an example of Abraham's generosity.
Greets the visitors,
right? He's post-surgery. He had a circumcision. He's sitting at the entrance to the tent convalescing. 3 visitors come by, and he goes running out to greet them and invites them into his tent, and he says, let me give you a little bit of bread and water. And he gives them instead the cattle that they slaughtered. He gives them a huge feast. He's known for this generosity. He's known for hospitality. It comes out in a few different stories involving him. That's Abraham's character. But now let's take a look at the other one. The people he left behind. The nation of Aram. Tell me something. Not that long ago on the Jewish calendar, at some point we read something for a holiday that involved an Aramean. Does this ring a bell?
Haggadah.
Right? Arami Oved Avi, which admits of multiple translations, but the standard one, which I think is the correct one, is about a man by the name of Lavan. Lavan the Aramean. So a little bit of family history here, which for Trentonians should be easy, because Trentonians have all these family trees in their heads, so they know that everybody they meet is the first cousin of this one, and the sister-in-law of that one, and the, God knows what. I am so confused in this city. But for you, this is going to be a piece of cake. Abraham has a brother whose name is Nahor. Nahor has a son, Bituel, who has a daughter, Rivka. Abraham's son, Isaac, marries Rivka, Rebecca. Okay, so they're cousins who end up getting married. Rivka, Rebecca, has a brother, Lavan. So Lavan is Isaac's brother-in-law. Isaac and Rebecca have 2 sons, Yaakov and Esau, Jacob and Esau. Jacob needs to get married. He goes running off to Aram, to Lavan's house. The house of his uncle, right? Uncle Lavan. And soon to be father-in-law. Because Lavan has 2 daughters, Rachel and Leah. Right? Okay, so we're good. That's the relationship between these families. Lavan is Jacob's uncle, but he's also Jacob's father-in-law. Twice over. Okay? What do we know about Lavan's character? Tricky.
Well, tricky. He tricked,
sneaky.
He tricked him.
He tricked him. Well, how did he trick him?
Having
him marry Leah instead of Rachel. Right, he switched the wives. But we knew he was tricky long before that. We knew...
It's not the
right, but even before that, you're right, but...
Is that the Bedeccan comes from that?
Yes, that's what they say is the origin of the Bedeccan practice at a wedding. The practice of having the groom be the one to put the veil down is that he has an opportunity to make sure first that, yeah, it's really her. it's a nice photo op, you know, you can turn to the camera, give a thumbs up. But even before that, you see, when Isaac needs to get married, and he ends up marrying Rebecca, Laban's sister, Isaac has a problem. He's not allowed to leave the land of Israel. And therefore, instead, Eliezer, the servant of Abraham, goes to find him a wife. Yeah. So Eliezer gets to the house, and he has camels with him, and he has jewelry with him, and he gives Rebecca jewelry, and Rebecca goes home and tells them about this stranger at the well, who is very interested in their family history. And take a look at source number 9. Rebecca tells the story to Laban, her brother. And when Laban saw the ring and bracelets on his sister's hands, and when he heard Rebecca's words saying, "Thus the man said to me," he went to the man who was standing with the camels at the well. And he said, "Come, you who are blessed by God, why should you stand outside? I have cleared the house and a place for the camels." He hears about money, and he makes a beeline to go bring in Eliezer. And they negotiate and say, "Well, will she marry him?" And she, "Yes, she'll marry your master's son, absolutely." And they stay overnight, and the next morning they're ready to leave. And look what happens, the last line in number 9. When she's all set to go, and her brother and mother said, "Will you go with this man?" I should have translated the verse right before it. The line right before it, they said, "You know what? Let her stay with us. Let her stay another year. Let her stay 10 months. Then she'll go." They're trying to renegotiate the terms. To which, ultimately, the question is put to her, and she said, "I'm going. I'm not interested in sticking around here. Been real. See you later." And she goes. But the point is, Laban is trying to renegotiate the terms of the agreement for Rebecca. And then we flip the page and move down a generation, and Jacob shows up at Laban's house. But Jacob is not Eliezer. Eliezer showed up with a whole bunch of camels loaded with wealth. Jacob has nothing, because he fled the house because his brother wanted to kill him. So he went running with nothing. So he shows up, and look what happens. Source number 10. "And when Laban heard about Jacob, his nephew, he ran to greet him, and he hugged him, and he kissed him, and he brought him home." Beautiful. Just such an emotional scene. If I didn't know anything about Laban, I would say it's touching. Yeah. But I do know something about Laban. And so do the sages who read this, and they said, it's not what's going on. He's wondering where the money is. So he sees him. It's nothing there. So he hugs him, figuring it must be on his person. It's not there. Maybe there are gems in his mouth. And he kisses him, all in an attempt to find this. I think the Medrash may be going a little bit far in its read. But there's no mistaking what Laban is like. He's not there just to say, "Wow, you came all this way. Let me make you feel welcome." That's not who he is. As a matter of fact, there's a great passage. When Jacob first shows up in town, he goes to the well, because that's what all eligible young men in the Torah do. They all go to the well and they find their wives there. Jacob is looking around, wants to know where Laban is. So he asks the shepherds at the well, "Do you know Laban, son of Nahor?" And you get one word response: "Vayomru yadanu." They say, "We know." That's it. It's not an enthusiastic response, like this is, salt of the earth type of guy who everybody's a fan of. In any case, we've got Laban established. He's already pegged as somebody who is in it for the money. And then you get to the story of Rachel and Leah. Source number 11. I brought it for you on the page, even though you know the story, just to show you how the words work. And Jacob loved Rachel. And he said, I will work for you for 7 years for Rachel, your daughter, the younger one. That's actually what he said.
Very specific.
Very. So much so that in modern Hebrew.
Specific.
Right. In very specific. In modern Hebrew, when you want to say to somebody, I specified everything in the agreement, you say, Rachel bitcha ktana, Rachel, your daughter, the younger one. To say, it's all been spelled out. And Laban said, sure, better that I give her to you than to another man. Stay with me. And he works for 7 years. And he thinks he's marrying her. And it was in the morning, behold, she was Leah. Oops. And he said to Laban, what is this that you've done to me? I worked with you for Rachel. Why have you tricked me? And Laban said, it shall not be done thus in our land to give the younger before the older. Finish this week, Sheva Brachos, and I'll give you this one too. This one.
However.
This one. For the additional 7 years of work you shall do for me. That's all. It's important to understand what actually happened here. It's important to realize what was really going on. In Lavan's version of this, he didn't lie to him. You wanted to marry Rachel. You still can marry Rachel. That's the deal. However, you have to marry Leah first. So therefore, it's going to be 14 years. It's not going to be 7 years. And I'm just not going to tell you until you're too late. You didn't do anything about it. But it gets worse. Because after this story, he continues to work for Laban. And then he says, you know, it's time for me to go home. And Laban says, you know, I've really done well having you here. I should pay you. Okay. And they set up an agreement for what he should be paid. Right? He says, set up the sheep and all the sheep that produce sheep of a certain type of a formation on their hide, striped, speckled, spotted, whatever it is, those will be mine. And they separate out all the sheep that already have that state so that he can't use Mendelian genetics in order to breed the sheep that he wants. Separates all of them out. All he has left are white sheep. Laban thinks this is going to be great. There's no way he's going to get any speckled and striped sheep out of the deal. And lo and behold, Jacob gets sheep anyway. However, we find out that Laban keeps switching the terms. Along the way, he changes the agreement multiple times. Until finally, Jacob says, you know what? This isn't working. I better get out. They all hate me. They all think that I've stolen their father's sheep. Better that I should leave. And so he does what every Jewish man is supposed to do, which is he asks his wife for permission. He says, what should I do? Can we leave? And that's what you see. Oh, I'm not kidding. In number 12.
And was he Jewish?
So it depends how you define Jewish. If by Jewish you mean somebody who received the Torah at Sinai, then the answer is no. If by Jewish you mean descendant of Abraham and Sarah, then the answer is yes. That's part of the question of what defines us. So take a look at number 12. And he said to them, Jacob says to his wives, I see that your father's face is not toward me like yesterday and the day before. I mean, he doesn't like me anymore. And the God of my father came to me, told me it's time to go. You know that I have worked for your father with all of my strength. And your father has tricked me, changing my salary 10 times over. But God has not let him harm me. And Rachel and Leah answered, and they said to him, do we have a share and portion in our father's house anymore? He thinks of us as strangers. He has sold us. He has also eaten our money. For all of the wealth that God has saved from our father belongs to us and to our children. Now do all that God has told you. They said, we're good. We're okay leaving town. We're not interested in sticking around. Our father sold us, which is exactly what their father did, right? For 7 years of labor, for each of them. The point is, we're getting a picture of what Laban is like, and through him, what Aram, this region, is like. Abraham is a person of blessing. He's supposed to bless others, to be generous to others. Aram, on the other hand, is all about what can I get for myself. That's their tribal identity. And the best example of it is Jacob leaves town with his daughter, with his wives, Laban's daughters. They flee. Laban finds out they've left. Laban catches up to them. And Laban says to him, as part of the exchange with Jacob, what I brought here in number 13, he says, the daughters are my daughters. The sons are my sons. The sheep are my sheep. All you see is mine. That's his trait. That's his personality. So that here we get, by the splitting of the Jews from the Arameans, you get a second trait that teaches us what we are not supposed to be. We are supposed to be people of generosity, not people of greed. So we have morality, sexual morality, and we have generosity. Clear so far?
Yep.
And then the third and last piece. When we split off from ourselves, this is what I mean by that. After we leave Egypt, we run into trouble in the wilderness. We don't have water. We don't have food. The Egyptians are pursuing us. Right? We have problems. We have manna after we complain. First we're hungry. We complain to God. Then we get manna. Yeah, there was something there that we had to appeal first in order to get it. So when we run into trouble, there's a constant refrain in what we say, and I brought it for you on the sheet. In source number 14, I brought you three different verses where it appears, and there are more. The first one is when we're at the sea, and the Egyptians are pursuing us. And the Jews turn around and say, are there no graves in Egypt such that you took us to die in the wilderness? Second example is taken when they're upset because they don't have any meat to eat. They only have the manna. Why then did we leave Egypt? The third time is after the incident with the spies. When the spies tell them that they can't conquer the land, let us change direction and return to Egypt. They would like to go back to be Egyptian again. And God's response is telling. I brought you the three different verses in source number 15. At the sea, God says, for as you have seen Egypt today, you shall never see them again, ever. The second verse that's in number 15 is part of the instructions regarding kings, that a king should not have too many horses. And it says, your king shall not take you back to Egypt to gain horses. God has said, you shall never go back that way again. And then the third one is a prediction of suffering in the event that we don't keep our covenant. You will be returned to Egypt in ships on the route regarding which I said you would never see it again. So the ultimate punishment for us is to be brought back to Egypt. And what this is getting across...
A warning.
Yes, definitely a warning. But I think that what it's trying to say is that when we leave Egypt, it's not only about this is a nation that's going to go to a land, although obviously that's a focus, but also that we were something in Egypt. There was something that was our identity in Egypt.
We were slaves
in Egypt, that precisely.
That was identity?
Well, apparently we thought so.
Only after we left.
Yes. Well, that's always the way it is, right? After you leave, that's when you think, it wasn't so bad. But that's exactly the point, I think. We leave Egypt, and then we feel like, you know what? Being a slave had its merits. We had a stable life. They fed us. You know, there was something to that. And what God is saying is, that's not who you're meant to be. By taking you out of Egypt, I created another split. But it's not like the previous splits. It's not a split between Shem, Ham, Yafet. It's not a split between Aram and the descendants of Abraham and Sarah. It's a split between Jews as slaves and Jews as free people. Which are you going to be?
Yeah. At this point, you're about to enter the promised land.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't it supposed to be a whole new generation? And that those who experienced slavery are no longer alive? That's why they waited the 40 years. So in essence, they should have been tabula rasa.
And that would have been great. But we weren't there. You're right. You're right. The generation that is here at this point is should not be, you know, infatuated with life in Egypt.
Right.
It's worth noting they're not all dead. Meaning
yeah,
that
it's too early for all of them to be gone.
Well, no. At the end of the 40 years, the men who were of military age at the time of the spies all die out. So the men who were between 20 and 60 are all gone. However, the women survive.
And
the children who have been under 20 also survive. So there is some memory of it.
Yeah.
But I think it's also making a point about how hard it is to break out of that. It's not straightforward. It's not a matter of, well, you never experienced it, so you're not going to long for it. There's still that feeling of, you know, maybe we were better off back then.
But to a great extent, it's a fear of the unknown as well.
Oh, yeah.
It's not only a question of leaving, it's a question of what you're going to. They didn't have a clue.
Right.
So
it's fear of the unknown, but I think it's more than fear of the unknown. I think I agree.
It's more than fear.
But I think it's also fear of God. Not in a good way. Not fear of God like reverence and awe and that.
Lack of trust.
And do I really want to agree to trade in Pharaoh for God? Do I want to be a servant of God? Do I want to be part of this covenant of Abraham and Sarah, which is going to require an awful lot of me?
And how do I know where I'm going?
Well, at this point they know. By the end of this,
yes,
they already
know. They know because they've been told, but they haven't lived it.
Right. That's true. They have not lived it yet. And that's actually going to come into play in the next passage. That's a perfect segue. The Jews come into the land under Joshua. And here is where the split becomes permanent. It's a passage from the fifth chapter of Joshua. It's source number 16 on the sheet. The Jews come into the land. They fight their initial wars with the city of Jericho, with another city called Ai. They fight two wars there. And then we get a command from God for Joshua to circumcise the males. Because in Egypt, they had a brit. Because in order to bring the Korban Pesach, in order to bring the Pesach sacrifice before leaving, the males needed to have a brit milah. That was required. However, they didn't do the circumcision in the wilderness. Why didn't they do it in the wilderness for 40 years? So the usual answer, the traditional answer is because it wasn't safe. You didn't know whether you were going to have to travel at some point. You're going to travel through the wilderness with a baby that just had a surgery. That's not a wise thing to do. So they said, you know what? We're not doing this right now. So in source number 16, we find that Joshua, at the beginning of chapter 5, at that time, God told Joshua, make stone blades and circumcise Israel again. Meaning they had the brit. Not that someone needs it twice. Don't get scared. But just like it was done before you entered the wilderness, now it's going to be done again. And Joshua made stone blades. He circumcised Israel. The place is called Kibat Ha'aralot. And then God said to Joshua, today I have removed the shame of Egypt from you. And they called the place Gilgal until today. Israel camped in Gilgal. They performed the Pesach. They brought the Pesach sacrifice. And they ate of the land's produce and so on. So here's my question. What is it that removed the shame of Egypt? When it says here, I have removed the shame of Egypt from you, what was it that removed the shame of Egypt?
The circumcision.
Right? That seems to be what removed the shame of Egypt. That's a straightforward read of the text.
No,
why? Why does Brit Milah remove the shame of Egypt? What does that mean?
Separate them from our
Egyptians. There were Egyptians who had circumcision. Not all Egyptians were circumcised, but definitely some of them were.
Commitment?
Commitment meaning? Commitment to?
Confirmation of the covenant.
Confirmation of the covenant that goes way back when, right? I think it's, and maybe this is what you mean by recommitment to this covenant. The shame, what was the shame of Egypt in the first place?
Their
Slavery, to be known as slaves. You know, I'll never forget it. In 2009, Barack Obama made a speech about Israel and about the right of Jews to the land. But he predicated the right of Jews to the land on the Holocaust.
Right.
He said, you know, they suffered so much, and Europe said, you know, we recognize what we've done wrong, and we're going to give them this land.
Right.
We are not defined as, you know, the Holocaust. That's not, we had an attachment to this land going back thousands of years. What he was doing, well-meaning or not, I leave that to your politics, but what he was doing was delegitimizing Jews living in the land of Israel.
Absolutely.
He was delegitimizing our nation.
Yeah.
Absolutely. He was applying the idea of a religion. We're an Am, we're a people.
Right.
Encompassing everything, and he didn't understand that, or he chose
not. We're not defined by the Holocaust. We're not defined by the Holocaust.
I think he was ignorant anyway in areas, in that part of the world. He was ignorant.
He loved the power of the Arabs to say,
and not well-meaning.
We should be giving them a land of Europe. That's who killed them.
Yeah, that's right. So that to me, though, is what we were trying to get rid of here.
Yeah. Yeah.
The shame of Egypt is that people are going to look at the Hebrews and say, oh, they were slaves in Egypt and then they broke out. And our national origin story is going to be slaves who were then miraculously freed. That's not our story.
No.
Our story begins with Abraham and Sarah living in the land, and Isaac and Rebekah, and Jacob and Rachel and Leah. That's part of our story. And that's why Brit Milah removes the shame of Egypt. Because Brit Milah testifies that we had a story before then. This covenant goes back to Abraham and Sarah before they had their first, before they had Isaac, after Ishmael. But that's the idea. And so what the circumcision does is it splits us from ourselves as slaves to say we're not slaves, we're Israelites. And that's why it's so important at this stage that we do it now. And really, it was a crazy thing for us to do. You just entered the land. You fought war with Jericho. You destroyed Jericho. You fought a war with Ai, the city of Ai, and you lost. Then you fought a second war against them, and that war you won. So now is a good time for us to render all of our males vulnerable. Right? Remember the story of Shem with Shimon and Levi?
Yeah.
That's not smart. But we did it, and we did it early on, making ourselves vulnerable because it was so important that we gain this new identity. And so it is that first we have the Brit Milah, and then we're ready to bring the Pesach offering. Then we're ready to say, we slaughter the god of the Egyptians, this lamb, and now we're ready to eat from the land. No more manna for us, this food of the wilderness. It's the food of our own land, the land that is our heritage. And so that's why God emphasizes to us so frequently, back in the verses that you saw in number 15, you're not going back to Egypt. That's not where you belong. That's not who you're supposed to be. You're not slaves. You are residents of this land. And as a product of that split, we receive the Torah. Take a look at number 17. This is what happens at Sinai. Moses takes the book of the covenant, he reads it in the nation's ears, and they say, whatever God says, we will do, and we will hear. Right? Which is supposed to encapsulate our acceptance of the Torah. I don't even know what's in it, but I accept it. I'm not a slave of Pharaoh. I have a covenant with God. And there, too, we find a split in accepting that Torah. And this will be the last bit. Take a look at number 18. It's a classic verse, but it gets skipped because it's at the end of the Torah and people are tired by then. Moses speaks to the Jews. And he says, God came from Sinai. He illuminated from Seir. He was manifest from Mount Paran. He arrived from Ribavot Kodesh, which I'm not going to translate its own term. On his right was the law of fire for them. This text is very hard to translate. What in the world are you talking about? God came from Sinai, illuminated from Seir, manifest from Mount Paran. On his right was a law of fire. What is this describing? What is it about? Can you tell? It defies simple translation. So, the sages in the Talmud looked at it and said, we know what this is about. This is about God giving the Jews the Torah. What nation lived in Seir? Yeah, know your Bible. What nation lived in Seir?
The Seirites.
You'd be better than that. Right, Esav lives in Seir. Esav lives in Seir. Who lives in Paran? That's even harder.
Jacob.
No.
Nope. Ishmael. Ishmael lives in Paran. What's describing here is God taking a tour before he gets to Sinai. Carrying the Torah with him, he goes to visit Esav, and he goes to visit Ishmael. And
saying I'm not giving
it to you?
Oh, close. They turn it down. The way that Talmud tells the story, God goes to Esav, and he says, would you like the Torah? Bingo. They ask, well, what's written in it? Unlike the Jews who say, we will do and we will hear, they want to know, so what's in it? And we ended up being the lawyers, we'll figure. What's in it? And the response is, it says, don't kill. Oh, we're not interested. That's not for us. Right. And then God offers it to Yishmael in Paran. And they say, what's written in it? Oh, don't steal. Thanks, that's not for us. Now, leave aside what this says about our vision of our neighbors. Because that's really a good discussion in its own right. And where did we get the idea that they're like this? The answer is it goes back to their ancestors and what Esav was known for in the Torah and what Yishmael is known for in the Torah. But the point isn't that. The point that we draw here is God offers the Torah to the world. He offers the Torah to the different nations, and they don't want it. We are the ones who accept it. And that's the lesson of this third split. To say we are not servants of the nations, we are not slaves of Egypt. We are members of a covenant with God, as symbolized when we first entered the land with the Brit Milah. So what we've seen, I hope, in the past hour, is the definition of Jewish traits as seen through the formation of the nation in the Torah. First, the splitting of the sons of Noah. Specifically, splitting off from Ham and Canaan, in which Ham and Canaan are known for sexual immorality, and we are being told, identify yourselves by moral conduct. Don't emulate them. The second split, the split of Abraham and Sarah from Aram. Aram is identified with greed, as in Lavan and his career. Abraham is told, be a source of blessing. You should be looking to be generous and to help the people of the land. Help the nations around you. That's our second hallmark. And then the third hallmark is not to be slaves, to be known as the slaves from Egypt, but rather to be the people who have a covenant with God that goes back to our national origin and then continues once we re-enter our land. There's more to say, but God willing, we'll do more on the topic of Jewish traits next time. Thank you. Thank you.